I should also thank Tim, in addition to, you know, the fact that he invited me, he was actually the person who sort of like sparked my interest in this particular subject, these quantum many-body scars that I'll define later. You know, just to sort of set the scene, can I move this? Oh yeah, that's better, right? I just want to sort of, this is a problem in quantum dynamics that is quite interesting, in my view, and it's been getting a lot of people excited recently. Just a little word about, you know, why the excitement about quantum dynamics. First of all, it's sort of a fundamentally interesting question because it's sort of the questions of quantum dynamics forces us to think about how many-body physics works beyond the context of ground states, which is where we're sort of very comfortable thinking about things. And there are also many new experiments in various quantum simulation platforms that are becoming available that are allowing us to sort of address these questions. And also the question of dynamics is relevant to quantum information applications. For example, when and how is quantum information lost and how can it be retained? So this quantum many-body scar subject is sort of, it's about a possibly new regime of non-ergodic quantum dynamics. So I'm gonna sort of give some exposition on this. But I use the word non-ergodic, so I wanna talk for a little bit about what does quantum ergodicity mean? What does quantum dynamics look like in generic many-body systems? And what are some known alternatives to this kind of behavior? So the typical type of system of setup that I wanna consider is the setup of a quantum quench, where we start with some initial state psi. We hit it with the unitary evolution operator, and then we ask, you know, what happens? I'll just say for an operational definition of ergodicity, the system has ergodic dynamics when it relaxes to a locally thermal state regardless of its initial condition. So when I say locally thermal, what I sort of mean is, you know, if you think about the system, you partition it into two parts, A and B, you can form the reduced density matrix that you get from just performing the trace over system B. And that gives you a density matrix for system A. And I'll say that the system is ergodic if the reduced density matrix looks something like a Boltzmann density matrix for an equilibrium quantum system. And it should be, in some sense, independent of the initial condition that I use. The intuition here is that if you restrict yourself to only thinking about quantities in region A, the system is sort of ergodic if the region B can act as a bath for A. Yes?
That limit of T going to infinity, mm-hmm. What do you mean by that, like time compared to what scale?
It should be long compared to basically any intrinsic scale in the Hamiltonian. So for example, if you have a system of spinless fermions, it should be many hopping times, for example. Okay, so that's kind of a dynamical definition, but you can also formulate a definition of ergodicity at the level of individual many-body eigenstates, and this kind of goes under the name of the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. There are much more rigorous definitions of these things. I just want to kind of give a flavor. One way of thinking about ETH is that, you know, in some sense, it just says that for every eigenstate, E, of your Hamiltonian, the reduced density matrix for region A in the state E looks like a Gibbs density matrix. And this has various consequences for expectation values of local observables. For example, if I take some observable O that's supported within region A, and I compute its expectation value in two energy eigenstates with energies that are sufficiently close to one another, they should look exactly the same because they should reduce to the same thermal expectation value. So it tells you something basically it's telling you that in the middle of the many-body spectrum, things start to kind of look featureless. And this is very nice. It's a very appealing picture because it tells us about how statistical mechanics can emerge at the level of individual eigenstates. And there's actually substantial numerical evidence for ETH in sufficiently, quote unquote, generic interacting quantum systems, starting with this paper in 2008, but there have been extensive checks of this type of behavior. One key metric that you want to use when sort of quantifying ergodicity is known as the entanglement entropy. So that's just sort of, it's just the entropy associated with the reduced density matrix for subsystem A. And ETH predicts that if you compute the entanglement entropy in an eigenstate obeying ETH, then because the reduced density matrix looks like a Gibbs density matrix, and you know the thermal entropy is extensive, then the entanglement entropy should scale with the volume of subregion A in a generic eigenstate that obeys ETH. So if you diagonalize your many-body Hamiltonian and you compute the entanglement entropy for every eigenstate, typically what you get is a curve that looks like this. So it has some maximum in the middle, and you know this expectation based on the scaling of thermal entropy with volume means that basically every state in the bulk of the many-body spectrum should have this volume law scaling. And in particular, if you look in the region close to this maximum and just appeal to your textbook StatMech definition of what the temperature is, you see that the states in the very middle of the many-body spectrum should look like infinite temperature states. Meanwhile, if you look just in the tails of the many-body spectrum, so just at the ground state and the low-lying excitations, there you expect that the entanglement entropy should scale with the area of the region A, the surface area. So the volume, if you want, of the partition between region A and B. And this kind of corresponds to taking the limit of temperature going to zero from below and above. And in fact, in gapped ground states of 1D systems, this is proven to hold. And the entanglement entropy is just a constant that's independent of system size. And in the rest of this talk, I'm actually just going to restrict to 1D systems. So when I say area law, you should have this in mind. So just to summarize what I've said so far, ETH is basically a way of saying that every eigenstate is in some sense thermal, and all finite energy density eigenstates have volume law scaling of entanglement. And as far as we can tell, this is quite common for Hamiltonians that are sufficiently generic. So I mean, basically for systems that are not integrable, not exactly solvable. This appears to be true almost always. But, you know, is it really always? No. So there are exceptions to this rule. And one sort of famous, very dramatic exception is known as many-body localization. And in this class of examples, which typically occurs in strongly disordered systems, basically every state, you know, the ground state, but also states in the middle of the many-body spectrum have area law scaling of the entanglement. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how this works now, just so that we can have a nice point of comparison for later. So what is MBL? Typically, the way that people start talking about it is if you start with non-interacting particles in a potential landscape with some randomness that has this energy scale W associated with it, and then some hopping J. What Anderson showed in the 50s is that for any finite disorder strength, all eigenstates are exponentially localized around these potential wells. So that's single particle localization. Many-body localization is basically the generalization of this phenomenon to the interacting case. So in this example, if we have many particles and assume that they're hardcore bosons, then there's some nearest neighbor interaction scale delta. And what was shown at first perturbatively and later with numerics, you can see that actually transport ceases in 1D at finite interaction strength when the disorder is much stronger than the hopping or interaction. So this is kind of an interesting phenomenon, but arguably even more interesting is this new perspective that's sort of since emerged, since this early work on many-body localization, which is that many-body localized systems are, they're not explicitly integrable, but they do have a complete set of emergent local conserved quantities, or at least that is one way of describing the phenomenology of these kinds of states.
What
what does complete mean here?
Yeah, so complete means the following. So I have a bunch of operators. I'll call them n tilde I. And complete basically means that by labeling the values of these n tilde sub I operators, which are all mutually commuting and commute with the Hamiltonian, I can obtain every eigenstate in the Hilbert space. So basically, I need as many of, basically the number of values of these integrals of motion has to equal the number of states in my Hilbert space. And I should point out that there is proof by John Imbrie that such objects can be constructed in a particular model of many-body localization. There are also numerical schemes that people have used to try to look for these objects. But in general, they're not easy to find. And I would say that it's not rigorously proven that they exist at all, when the disorder strength is really finite. It's really a phenomenological description. It's not, it's not necessarily true that every many-body localized system has to have a complete set of integrals of motion. That's actually an ongoing research topic right now. But basically, heuristically, what are these objects? I mean, I call these n tilde because they're basically kind of related to the local density. So basically, if particles can't hop, then the local density becomes almost conserved. So the idea is that they should be related to the local density by some unitary dressing. But finding the unitary that does this might be very hard. But so if we take this phenomenological definition as a given, then various aspects of MBL phenomenology come out. One aspect that's been confirmed numerically in many, many body localized systems is that all eigenstates have area law entanglement. That actually follows from this discussion, basically, because these things are basically, equivalent by a local unitary circuit to product states. So they're not very heavily entangled. Another aspect of many-body localized systems that's well described by this kind of picture is the dynamics. So many-body localized systems retain memory of their initial state out to arbitrarily late times. So this is an easy experiment to do on your computer because you can go to arbitrarily late times if you're doing full exact diagonalization. But there have also been some experiments in cold atom systems where they prepare some initial, say, charge density wave state at strong disorder. They let the system evolve, and basically they see that this imbalance, which is kind of a proxy for how similar is the time evolved state to the initial state, you can see that this imbalance kind of gets stuck when the disorder is sufficiently strong. So this is something that is well described by this picture. So one interesting thing that can happen in many body localized systems that I'll get back to later is that because in these systems, all eigenstates have area law entanglement, you can actually have interesting things going on in eigenstates of MBL systems. In particular, you can have something that's known as eigenstate order or localization protected order, which are sort of, you can imagine them as basically just, they're like stable infinite temperature quantum phases, basically. So this has been a very active subject. And essentially, what's been confirmed numerically many times over, and also using real space renormalization group schemes, things like this, is that individual eigenstates of many-body localized systems can support long-range order in the form of spontaneous symmetry breaking. Like this work found an MBL spin glass that has Z2 symmetry breaking, kind of akin to what you might expect in the ground state. Although this is a one-dimensional system, so it's important to point out that these kinds of things are thermodynamically forbidden at finite temperature in 1D, but nevertheless, we have eigenstates in the middle of the spectrum that do support this kind of order. Another thing that people have thought about is the possibility of having symmetry-protected topological order in highly excited states, and that appears to be something that's possible in MBL systems as well. I just want you to keep that in mind because that concept is going to come back later. Just by way of finishing the introduction, it looks like so far we've seen sort of two paradigms for or two classes, if you want, of possibilities for highly excited states in quantum many-body systems, And you could basically, you know, if you look at ETH systems, basically you have volume loss scaling in the middle of the spectrum, area loss scaling in the tails. And then for MBL systems, you just have area law everywhere. And you might ask, are these the only two possibilities? The answer is no. In particular, there are various degrees to which the ETH can be violated. So MBL is an example of an extreme violation of ETH, where every single eigenstate is not behaving the way you would expect at finite energy density. There's also a concept known as weak ETH, where quote unquote almost all eigenstates are thermal. As far as I know, the first example of a system doing this was, or this concept was written about in this paper. Basically, the idea is that if you take the limit of system size going to infinity, you can have a certain number of non-thermal eigenstates in your spectrum, but as a fraction of the total Hilbert space volume, this number of states is going to zero in the thermodynamic limits. So, you know, one sort of way that you might pictorially visualize this is, you know, you just imagine a generic eigenstate at finite energy density is following the ETH prediction, but then you have a few outliers. And, you know, by a few, I really mean that this number is going to zero. And they have anomalously low entanglement. You know, you might ask, well, okay, is it possible for this to be, for these kinds of states to be relevant experimentally if their number is going to zero? Could, you know, are they important for dynamics that I would measure in an experiment? But you know, actually, they can be. So I'm going to talk about how this is possible. But there's been really a surge of interest recently in these kinds of systems due to recent experimental findings. So I'll talk a little bit about the experiment in question and set up the problem that I'm going to be thinking about for the rest of the talk. So the setup is from this experiment in Michalukin's group at Harvard, where they took basically an ensemble of rubidium atoms, and they trapped each atom in an individual optical tweezer. And what they can do basically is, you know, they can move the atoms with the tweezers, so they can control how far apart the atoms are from one another. That controls their interaction. And in this system, you know, I'm not going to get very deep into the atomic physics of how things work here. Basically, all you really need to think of these green dots as, these individual atoms, is as two-state systems, as sort of like Ising spins. So the ground state, the atomic ground state, we're going to think of that as the spin down local state. And then there's a particular highly excited Rydberg state of the atom that you can choose by, you know, using some kind of Rabi drive. And that corresponds to our spin-up state. So basically, every atom, things have been prepared in such a way that every atom is either going to be in its ground state or in a very highly excited Rydberg state. And basically, these atoms have a strong van der Waals interaction when neighboring atoms are excited. So that's just a consequence of the fact that this interaction scales with a high power of the principal quantum number. But you know, as I mentioned, they can use the tweezers to move the atoms. And if you tune the interatomic spacing to be such that only the interaction between nearest neighbors is strong, essentially what you do is if you have two atoms that are neighboring one another and they're both in their excited state, that configuration has a much higher energy than any other state in this Hilbert space. So what kind of emerges when you have very strong interactions is that there's a constraint, which is that, you know, two neighboring atoms cannot be in the excited state at the same time. So there's a model for this kind of constraint that it's realized to a very good approximation in the experiment, and this is sometimes called the PXP or a constrained paramagnet model. And basically, it's called the PXP model because the Hamiltonian is PXP. So X is just a Pauli sigma X operator. And then these P's are projectors onto spin down. So basically, this Hamiltonian will not flip a spin if one of its neighbors is pointing up, because that would put you in the constraint. That would basically violate the constraint. So you flip the spin, but you only flip it if neither of the neighbors is pointing up. So this is actually a strongly interacting model. Even though it's a paramagnet, the constraint is for our purposes, it's a hard constraint, and that's a strong interaction. So they can realize this model in the experiment, and they did some dynamics and found, they did a dynamics experiment, and they found something unexpected, which is that if they prepare this array of atoms in the nail state, where you have an alternating pattern of the atoms being in their excited and ground states, that's sort of visualized here in this density plot, where white is basically corresponding to spin up and black is corresponding to spin down. So when they prepare this initial state, and then they turn on the Hamiltonian, this PXP Hamiltonian, what they find is basically that the pattern of spin up and spin down just oscillates in time while maintaining this kind of up down structure, this alternating structure of spin up and spin down. This is just another plot. This is sort of a 1D version of this plot where they look at the domain wall density and they find, again, oscillations. And these time scales are matching. So this happens when you prepare the nail state, but it turns out that if you prepare a generic initial product state, this doesn't happen. And this is highly unexpected. This model nominally should satisfy ETH. It's a strongly interacting model. It's not integrable. You can check, for example, statistics of level spacings, and it looks very well described by random matrix theory. But nevertheless, there's this strong initial state dependence, and that basically rules out the possibility of ETH because it's manifestly non-ergodic because there are initial product states that have sort of atypical dynamics. But also it rules out MBL, because in MBL, it doesn't matter what kind of initial product state you prepare, any initial product state gets stuck. So it's not consistent with either ETH or MBL. Also, by the way, the system is clean, so it's not disordered, so MBL really is not, it seems to be out the window, but it's still consistent with weak ETH. So then, after this experiment came out, people started looking at possible explanations. Basically, this concept that's been termed quantum many-body scars was proposed. I'm not going to get really into why they called it scars. There's some analogy with quantizing classical systems that are chaotic. And looking at the wave functions there, but it's not necessarily the most relevant to what I'm going to talk about. But basically, you can boil it down to the existence of a certain number of states. In fact, there's L plus one, where L is the length of the chain, that have atypically high overlap with the nail state. So that's the state that they chose as their initial condition in the experiment. And they have energy, they have space, they're spaced in energy in such a way that basically the level spacing between any two consecutive states is nearly constant. So that's what this plot is. This plot is basically you take the nail state and you look at its overlap with every eigenstate, and then you see that this is on a log scale, but these guys with X's are what have been called the scar states. And the idea is that, this gives you an obvious explanation for why there are oscillations in the dynamics, because when you prepare this initial state, you're basically projecting the dynamics onto this set of states. And the coherence is just coming from the fact that there's this nearly constant energy spacing between consecutive states in this manifold. So, and you can check that the time scale of the oscillation matches up with this energy scale of this spacing. These scar states,
Right.
So that's one interesting property of the scar states. And also, it turns out that the scar states appear to violate the strong ETH. So if you look at the entanglement, so this is the entanglement entropy of every eigenstate in a finite-sized system. And the scar states are basically, you know, they're these lowest lying states here. So they have the lowest entanglement of everybody. And if you look at finite-sized scaling of these guys in the middle of the energy spectrum, they have entanglement that scales as the log of the system size rather than the volume. And you know, I'll point out that this is a numerical result, and I might touch later on whether this really stays log out to L equals infinity. But for our purposes right now, let's just say that it's a log forever. So you know, this is quite interesting, A, because it's an experiment that saw something unexpected, right? So it's a quantum simulation experiment. Typically, when you do a quantum simulation experiment, you already know what you're looking for, right? You're trying to, you know, that at least that's sort of the state of things at the moment. But this was unexpected. So I think that's one reason why people have been so interested in this subject. But also, there are just a lot of questions. So, you know, what are these states? Like, we know that they're equally spaced in energy, but like, what are they? Why are there L plus one of them? Why are their energies equally spaced? You know, there isn't necessarily a good understanding of that right now. Also, you know, how stable are these things to perturbations is another question you might ask. And also, you know, is there, what's the mechanism? Like, can we, if we know the mechanism for why these states are here, can we find other systems that might have the same kinds of states? So, you know, there's kind of this like detective story that's been going on where people have been trying to sort of clarify various points, among these points. So this is just kind of a sampling of various papers on the subject. And, you know, in particular, several have focused on stability or touched on the question of stability. And a few have looked at also how to generalize these kinds of models to other sort of constrained systems. I'm also gonna, this is gonna come back later, so I just wanna spend a second on stability. So I was asking, you know, are these states really stable? It turns out that, you know, in these two papers, a deformation of the Hamiltonian, so if this is the PXP model, there's a deformation that you can write down that's this sort of four-body term that has a variable range to it. You can actually, in particular in this second paper, it was shown that you can optimize these coefficients HD and make the range R large enough to sort of optimize the fidelity of the revival. So basically, the dynamics is reviving periodically. And you can sort of, by playing with these parameters, make it so that the system is really coming back to the same state as the one that you started in, to say one part in a million. You know, they found some formulas for these things. It's not too important, but the point is this deformation exists. This kind of tells you something about the stability, right? Because there's actually a deformation of the Hamiltonian that makes it better, right? So the phenomenon observed in the experiment is actually, it might be more useful to think about the phenomenon observed in the experiment as being some, the model realized in the experiment as being some perturbation to some putative perfect point where the revivals are really exact and the oscillations last forever. However, I should point out that, you know, we don't really know what this perfect point is. This model is not, the revivals are not perfect here. They're just sort of, you can make them better and better by adding more and more parameters to your model. But we don't know really what this perfect point looks like, but it seems there is evidence in favor of the fact that perhaps such a point exists. Sure.
So by perfect point, do you mean an integrable point or?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
Yeah. So there, you can actually construct toy. There, actually, I'll discuss an example of a system that has these kinds of scar states that is not integrable. So integrability could be one explanation, although then the scar states are not really atypical, right? Because every state in an integrable system is kind of special in a sense. This is going to be important because when I'm showing numerical results later, I'm going to show them also for this deformed model. So related to Chong's question, do we know of any other non-integrable Hamiltonians with ETH violating eigenstates? It turns out that one of the most famous Hamiltonians in condensed matter physics in the last 30 years actually has these states. So the AKLT chain, I'm not going to go into this in a lot of detail, but it's a spin chain. These red dots are spin ones. The Hamiltonian is a sum of projectors that basically project each neighboring pair of spin ones onto spin two. And there's a famous exact ground state of this model, which is represented pictorially like this. These circles are projectors onto spin one. These blue dots are sort of like fictitious spin half moments. And then these yellow bars are singlets. It has a famous ground state. Obviously it's a really important example of symmetry protected topological order because we can write its ground state down exactly, but it's not integrable. That's really important. Even though you can write down the ground state exactly, it's not integrable. So if you look at the statistics of energy level spacings of, every energy level in the whole spectrum, it really follows random matrix theory quite well. However, recently, Mudgalia et al. Found a sequence of exact excited states. So you can actually write down, in addition to the ground state, you can write down a bunch of excited states exactly. And these states are basically just proportional to some operator raised to the nth power acting on this ground state. And you can compute their energies. So the energy of the state S2n is 2n. And you can also compute their entanglement entropy exactly, because this is a low bond dimension MPO. This is an MPS. So the entanglement entropy scales like the log of the number of times you apply this operator. So when n over L is finite, that means that the state has finite energy density by definition, and its entanglement scales as the log of L. That sounds familiar. So now you can ask, okay, well, what are these states? And one way of representing the first excited state in this tower is, basically it's a spin two magnon that you create on top of the AKLT ground state, and the magnon has momentum pi. So basically the nth state in this sequence is just piling a bunch of magnons. You pile n magnons at momentum pi into this state. And when you have these n magnons, basically the fact that it's momentum pi, basically you can do calculations and see that the scattering of these magnons off of one another interferes destructively when all the magnons have momentum pi. So I don't really understand why that's true beyond the fact that I can do the calculation. So this is a phenomenon that I call pi magic, because I don't understand what it is.
So are these states the only non-several states in the AKLT chain?
That we know of, I guess. So I don't know of any other examples. There's some SU2 structure. So like these are just the highest weight states, but there is an SU2 degeneracy associated with the spin quantum number of these states. But these states and their SU2 friends are the only ones that I know. I mean, there are other low-lying states of the model that you can write down. I think Dan Arovas found a couple. So these are pretty special states.
Sorry?
Oh, yeah, sure.
How stable are these states under perturbations?
Not very stable. I mean, it's just it's Fermi's golden rule, basically. So you can compute the lifetime of the state just within perturbation theory. So it is special. It's special to this particular Hamiltonian. But it's interesting because it's a non-integrable model where we can write down an infinite tower of of excited states. That appears to be something that's pretty unique, pretty unusual. So the question that I'd like to ask is, and the question that our paper deals with is, could something like this be going on in the PXP model? And if you bring back this plot of the overlap with the Z2 state as a function of energy, here I've circled the special scar states. If you look at their momentum quantum number, it actually alternates between 0 and pi. So that's sort of one clue that maybe each time I'm going from one of these scar states to the next, I'm just adding a pi momentum magnon to my state. So that kind of suggests that maybe there's something to it. Also, the numerically obtained entanglement of the states in the middle of the spectrum, it goes like log L. So that would also be a consistent, that's a consistency check. So you can sort of ask, can we describe the scar states in terms of, say, nearly free magnons with momentum pi? So that's what we investigate in our paper. The answer is yes. So that's the subject of this work. So I'm going to sort of summarize our findings in this work and how we arrive at this conclusion. There's sort of two parts to the story. One is we develop a magnon description of the PXP scar states. So like, what are the magnons? That's one question. And then I'm also going to discuss some consequences of this magnon description. One interesting consequence is that if these states contain a macroscopic number of magnons with momentum pi, you can actually argue and confirm with simple numerics that these states have long-range order in both space and time. So these states basically have eigenstate order in the sense that we sort of typically associate with MBL states, but there's no MBL in the picture. So this is another, you can think of it as another mechanism for eigenstate order. So I'll focus on part one for now. So what are the magnons? So the way that we look for the magnons is...
Sure. What's the nature of the ground state?
Well, it's a paramagnet. It's not, there's a good trial wave function that was written down in the early 2000s. There was a DMRG study of this model. But it doesn't have like a simple, we don't know it exactly. We don't know what it is exactly. We just know that it's a paramagnet. And excitations above a paramagnet are magnons. So that's why I'm calling them magnons.
It's a trivial paramagnet or a, there's some symmetries in this model too, right? Like inversion.
Sure. I think it's just a trivial paramagnet. I don't think it's an SPT. At least I don't know of any evidence. It's possible. But I don't think that there are, if it is, it's not obvious at all, because it's not the AKLT state. It's not, we can't write down an expression for it. But, that is an interesting question. I don't really know the answer. But let's just assume that it's a trivial paramagnet for now. And yeah. All right. So to find the magnons, we use an old method. It's called the single mode approximation. So we just want to see, for starters, that there are stable magnons with momentum pi in the system. So what we do is we're basically going to build low energy excitations above the ground state using this operator zk. That's just the momentum k component of the local of the magnetization, basically. So if you look at the low-lying spectrum and plot it as a function of momentum, you get something that looks like this. So these circled states are the scar states. So you can see that their momentum alternates between 0 and pi, 0 and pi as you move. And then by basically applying this operator, so you can define these states k that are just zk acting on the ground state. And that's what these dots are showing. So these dots are showing the energies of these states. And then the color is indicating the overlap. And you see that there is a stable state at momentum pi, and it's actually the band minimum for these magnons. And just to give you an idea of how good these approximate states are, at L equals 24, this has 99.8% overlap with the first excited state. And then you could you can check and see, well, maybe this first excited state at zero momentum can be described as a state containing two magnons. So you can apply this operator z pi twice to the ground states, and then you know you can subtract off. There's a little bit of overlap with the ground state. But when you do this, you get a state that has 91% overlap here. So the natural question is, can you just keep going? So to investigate this further, we're going to try to do a better job of finding the creation operator for these pi magnons. So what we did was we did a numerical search for an operator that has this form, so s plus minus at pi. And it turns out that you can constrain what this operator is just using symmetries, like time reversal. There's a spectral reflection symmetry. And basically, this is just a linear combination of z pi, which is the operator that we were using before, and some real number times y pi, which is the pi momentum component of the projected y operator. So then what you do is you just try to find alpha that optimizes simultaneously the amplitude to create the first excited state by acting on the ground state, and the amplitude for the adjoint of this operator to annihilate the ground state. So we want something that's as close as possible to being a real creation and annihilation operator for these excitations. And you know, you can do this. We did numerics from L equals 12 to 30. And if you do finite size scaling, it looks like you extrapolate to a value of about 2.03. So from now on, just to sort of simplify things, we're going to use the operator s plus minus at pi is z pi minus plus I to y pi. This number two is interesting. You can kind of rationalize why that number is two, but I'm not going to go into it. Ask me later if you're interested. Okay, but now we have an operator that does a pretty good job of making a pi magnon. So you know, that suggests a natural basis of magnon states. So I have a state n that's just some normalization times this operator that we found raised to the nth power acting on the ground states. So I have these states. I can make them very easily. There's also a symmetry of this PXP Hamiltonian. There's an operator C that anti-commutes with the Hamiltonian and maps states with positive energy to states with negative energy. And it's an operator that squares to one. So if you want these magnon states to kind of respect this symmetry, you can also define reflected versions of these states. So there's this operator n tilde that's just basically you get by applying this operator c to the state n. And that's kind of basically like starting from the ceiling state, which is the highest energy state, and then you know annihilating magnons and coming down that way. So these are some states. That's nice, but you know they're not as nice as the AKLT states because these are just sort of they're basically ansatz states, and you know the number of these magnons isn't conserved, right? So basically these states n and n tilde they don't form an orthogonal set. So you know that's a problem, but it's not a horrible problem. So because basically the procedure that I'll describe is that we basically use these states to make a caricature of each scar state. So I'll describe how we do that. But the basic idea is that we'll use these n and n tilde states and try to see how well we can sort of use these states to represent the scar states. So our procedure for doing this is the following. So we define the vector space v pi. That's the span of all of these states n and n tilde. And the dimension of this space is L plus 2. And then what we do is we just do some, so we define this vector space by doing just a Gram-Schmidt orthogonalization on this set, and then we get an orthonormal basis EI. And then to see how good of a caricature we've made of these states, we compute the weight of each scar state M. So I'm defining an index m to label my scar states that goes from 0, which is the ground state, to L plus 1, which is the ceiling state. And for any scar state, we compute its weight, its total weight on this vector space, and we average over m. And then this is what we get. So this is just from L equals 18 to 26. And we're only looking at the k equals 0 sector. But you can see that, you know, at the largest system size we considered, there's maybe a 78% total weight on average of any given scar state on this basis. And you can compare that to a random state or you know, any other state in the same symmetry sector. And you know, you can easily see that you know, that number is, you know, the typical weight of such a state on this basis is just the dimension of that vector space divided by the total Hilbert space dimension. And at L equals 26, which is where this dot is coming from, it's like 0.003. So this is, you know, much, much larger than a random state. So okay, that's good. That kind of suggests that these Magnon states do a decent job of representing the scar states. But you might ask, okay, well, you know, can we do a little bit better, right? Because I mean, you know, you're sort of barely passing the class if you're getting a 78% on the final, right? So I wanna see if I can improve a little bit and maybe improve systematically. And actually you can do this. So basically what you do is you add states to this basis that you constructed. So I had a basis size L before, but that was just, I was putting every magnon in with momentum pi. And in principle, nothing prevents two pi magnons from scattering off of one another and coming out with a relative momentum with respect to one another. So there are these magnon interactions that are presumably there, but I don't know what they are. So to sort of try to capture some of those effects that I don't really understand, I can basically construct these states where I'll take one pair of magnons and give them some relative momentum. And that's what this state is doing. So there's a label N, which is sort of, you know, the total number of magnons. And then there's a label delta K that basically can take L values. And that's just the relative momentum of the two magnons. So this makes a vector space whose dimension goes like L squared. And when you do that, you know, these are the numbers that I was showing before. These blue dots are what you get using the new basis. So at L equals 26, for example, you go from 78% on average to like 96%, you know, 97%, say. So there's a dramatic enhancement, you know, after only a polynomial increase in the basis size. Now, this red line here is using the old basis v pi, so just only pi magnons, but I'm using the deformed model that I introduced before. So this is the, you know, this is the Hamiltonian with this long range deformation that makes the scar states basically better versions of themselves. And for the deformed model, actually, you can get a similar level of accuracy without using any scattering states. So this seems to suggest that the magnons are interacting more weakly as you approach this putative perfect point.
So what is the value of delta K, or the magnitude of it, the relative momentum?
Yeah, so basically it just goes in, you know, it's just quantized in units of 2 pi over L.
What happens if instead of having like this shaded one, you have another one with a different relative momentum? Will it improve your...
Yeah, so in principle, I mean, the sort of, you can do this ad nauseum, basically. You can do it until you get sick of it. And, you know, eventually, you know, every pair of magnons can have a different relative momentum, right? So, and then eventually you're going to get to a basis whose size is exponential, right? So obviously, you know, that's not much of an improvement. So the thing that's kind of interesting here is that we only need L squared states in an exponentially large Hilbert space to get a really good representation of these states. So this is that was kind of technical. That was just telling you kind of that there appears to be a magnon description of these states. But for the rest of the talk, I want to explore consequences of this magnon picture. Yeah.
Before you move on.
Sure.
So the importance of momentum pi, does it mean that the scars are really protected by translation symmetry? Otherwise, what does momentum pi mean?
Oh, not really. So I expect, but have not checked that, for example, if you have open boundary conditions,
okay,
this picture should still work. I can define the staggered magnetization operator in any, whether I have open or closed boundary conditions, right? So the idea is that if I had open boundary conditions, I would still use that staggered, I would use these staggered operators. And that's actually what happens in the AKLT case. So in the AKLT case, if you just use the same operator, and you still make excited states, even if you have open boundary conditions.
Open boundary condition is a little weak to break translation. Like, what if you have like weak disorder?
Yeah. So, if you add weak disorder, I haven't looked at that. The scar states do persist when you have weak disorder. I mean, their energies shift around a little bit. But there are still states that have a high overlap with the nail state in the spectrum. So that kind of...
That's from numerics?
Yeah, that's from numerics. But you know, the question of like robustness, I mean, it's hard to really say much about robustness because we don't have a point where all of this stuff is really exact at our disposal. But it appears that if you make very weak disorder, so the question is like weak compared to what, right? You need some scale. And I don't really know what that scale is. But you know, it appears that you know, there is some degree of robustness to these things. And I think people have checked, although I don't think that there are published results on it, that weak disorder doesn't screw everything up too badly.
So the numerics is all like ED, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think people have done dynamics using TEBD type, or you know, MPS based methods. And you know, there are some Krylov subspace methods that you can use to develop approximations to these states. And that was the work of Turner et al., Dima Abanin, Maxim Serbin, Zlatko Popic. So they developed sort of a Krylov space description. It's actually kind of spiritually similar to this, but there isn't this physical interpretation in terms of magnons. Yeah. All right. So let's see. All right. So I want to talk about consequences of this magnon picture. And you know, as I'm going to explain how you can see that there are long-range correlations in these states, and I'll show some of the data that we've found. You know, why might you think that there's long-range order, right? Well, it looks like the scar states are well described by states containing many magnons with momentum pi. So is there a sense in which I can think of these states as being kind of condensates of these magnons? So what do I mean by that specifically? What I mean is that you can look for off-diagonal long-range order in the following sense. So basically, if you compute the expectation value of S plus pi times S minus pi in one of these scar states and normalize appropriately, if this quantity remains finite in the thermodynamic limit, then there's something called off-diagonal long-range order. And that's when I say magnon condensate, what I mean is this is true. This appears to be true in the thermodynamic limit. And you can easily convince yourself that ETH predicts that this quantity is scaling to zero in the thermodynamic limit. So, you know, what we did is we just computed this quantity for various scar states. So these different colors here, these different M's, represent you know, expectation values of this quantity taken in different scar states. So if you look at the ground state, or the first scar state, or the second scar state, and then you do scaling, you see that these things are going to zero quite nicely as L is increased. So this is 1 over L, so you know, infinity is here. But then if you go, for example, to the scar state in the middle, in the exact middle of the many-body spectrum, you appear to get something that's scaling to something finite. and are, you know, basically this appears to happen for any scar state that's at finite energy density. So these guys are all kind of at zero energy density because there's, you know, they're basically order one number of magnons, if you like, above the ground state. But if you look at, for example, m equals l over 4, obviously I'm reducing the number of points that I have to do scaling with because, you know, I have to restrict myself to system sizes that are multiples of 4. But it looks like basically at every size where we can do finite size scaling with more than like 3 points or something, you know, these things appear to be scaling to something finite. Yeah?
So this EPH predicts 0, is that because that's equal to the thermal expectation value? Or
yeah, that's it. You can just do an infinite temperature average of this quantity, basically. You can compute the trace of this operator over the Hilbert space and then divide by the Hilbert space dimension. And basically, that's going to doom this thing to be scaling to 0. And another interesting tidbit is that if you look at the deformed model, actually, the scaling appears to be enhanced. So, you know, if you're not super convinced by, you know, the way that this thing is scaling, like, oh, well, maybe this thing is turning down. Maybe that's true. But, if when I deform the model, now it's actually looking quite good. So this appears to be, as far as we can tell, a property of the scar states themselves. So, like, when we enhance the scar states, when we enhance the revivals that are associated with them, we enhance this property. So, you know, basically, for both the pure and deformed PXP models, it appears that the finite energy density scar states have finite pi magnon density. So this is a new property of these eigenstates. So before, basically, we knew what expectation values of, you know, generic local operators look like in these scar states, and you can sort of quantify deviations from ETH that way. We also knew that they had, you know, the wrong quote unquote entanglement scaling, and we can add this to the list, basically. They have, it really looks like long range order. So, and you know, I was working in momentum space, but also you can work in real space and, you know, have like a more sort of standard picture of long range order. So, if you compute correlators like ZI, ZI plus R, and only look at the connected part, you see very nice oscillations with momentum pi if you look at the E equals zero scar state. So this is the scar state right in the middle of the many body spectrum. But then if you just choose a random eigenstate with the same energy density, you see that it goes to zero exponentially as you would expect based on ETH. So you can actually calculate the scaling of this thing by hand within ETH, and you can see that it falls off exponentially. And these blue points are clearly not doing this. Also, if you look at the ground state doesn't have long range order either. So these oscillations are not there. This is happening for the ZZ correlator, but it also happens for the YY correlator. And basically the reason is that this S plus pi, I showed you that S plus pi has this large expectation value, or like S plus pi, S minus pi has a very large expectation value. And to build that operator, I need Z's and I need Y's. So basically, I would expect to see something like this. And actually, you can confirm that you see something like this for the Y's as well. So this is basically, you can think of this is also like a, this is something that could be tested experimentally. So you can measure correlation functions and look for this long range correlation. Whoa. Oh, that's because I hit escape. That was dumb. Play again. I'm not done yet, because I have to talk about time crystals. before I talk about time crystals.
Yeah, but you said you can measure these two-point correlation function experiment, but isn't the experiment actually showing the one-point function of that, in the sense that you can see in the real-time evolution that the ZZ pattern actually is staggered even at later times with the revival?
Yeah, that's right. So you can think of this, so actually, and you know, the initial state that they chose is a Z eigenstate, right? So you're actually kind of looking at that correlator already in the experiment. So I'll have a slide on this later, but you can sort of think of this as like a post facto sort of reinterpretation of the experiment. So you know, you could also, you could ask the question, well, you know, because, but there's, but this is important, right? Because if I prepared an ensemble of free spins in, you know, in an alternating pattern and then put them in a field, they would all precess, right? And if all of the energies, on-site energies, were the same and the magnetic field is uniform, they would all precess and they would remain in phase with one another, right? But what we're saying here is that this is actually an interaction effect. It's not, you know, this is happening, you know, these are, you know, if you looked at connected correlators, you would see this. And also, you know, if they can prepare the nail state, but, you know, if you look at this Y correlator, then you can really probe connected correlators and disentangle this from, you know, this sort of trivial example that I was talking about. Yeah, that's right. But there's something even weirder, although I'm going to convince you that, I'll try to convince you that it's actually not weird at all, which is that actually, so there's long-range order in space that I was just talking about, but also these eigenstates have long-range order in time. So they're examples of time crystals, okay? And that sounds really weird, but it's not, and I'll tell you why. So what are time crystals first? I'm just going to talk about this for two slides. So the notion of a time crystal was proposed by Wilczek in 2012, and basically he was asking a totally reasonable question, which is, you know, we know that in, you know, spatial crystals form by spontaneous breaking of translation symmetry. So could you imagine having a spontaneous breaking of time translation symmetry where maybe in the ground state your system just kind of decides spontaneously to rotate? Is that kind of thing possible? And he was thinking of ground state order because that's kind of the most natural place to look if you're used to thinking about ground states. Now, Watanabe and Oshikawa in 2015 did two things in this paper. They provided a nice definition of what time crystal needs to satisfy in order for us to really call it a time crystal. So basically, you can define an order parameter, phi, and say that it has some finite wave vector, g. And they basically propose this criterion that if this correlation function, phi g, phi minus g, at unequal times, so t and zero, if, you know, divided by the volume, you want to normalize everything appropriately and take the limit of volume going to infinity. But if this quantity approaches a time periodic function at late times, then we call that a time crystal. And the reason that you want some correlation function definition rather than some one-point function definition is that basically, if it was a one-point function, then a single spin in a magnetic field would be a time crystal, and we want to exclude silly things like that. So this is basically telling you that this, you know, the oscillations in a putative time crystal would have to be, you know, really correlation effects. So that was the first thing they did in this paper. The second thing that they did in this paper is that they proved that it's impossible for a system to satisfy this property if it's in its ground state or if it's at thermal equilibrium. So basically, they provided a no-go theorem after, you know, providing an appropriate definition. However, they didn't say anything about highly excited states. So that's the key here. So these scar states are highly excited states of many-body systems. They're not ground states, and they're not equilibrium states. They're not ETH obeying states. So we can basically, if we see that something like this is there, you know, it doesn't contradict the no-go theorem. That's important. So, but, you know, where have people looked for time crystals? So because this no-go theorem doesn't really have anything to say about out of equilibrium systems, one place where people have had a lot of success finding time crystals is in periodically driven systems. So these are called Floquet time crystals. So these are systems that are driven periodically in time, and then they spontaneously decide to break the discrete translation symmetry, time translation symmetry of the drive, down to a subgroup. So it's kind of like a Pyrrhus transition in time, where you have some periodicity that gets reduced to lower periodicity. And there have been a lot of examples of this in theory in various kinds of systems. And also, there have been actually a surprisingly large number of experiments that have seen these kinds of things. So Floquet time crystals, you know, we know that they're there. We accept that they're there. But what about continuous time crystals? So has any progress really occurred on this front? And this subject is still a little bit controversial because, you know, there haven't really been any good examples so far. I'm arguing that PXP is an example, but it has been proposed to occur in systems with off-diagonal long-range order. So that actually, you know, these kinds of this is sort of, you know, so that's one possibility. Like you have two weakly coupled condensates. One is at a finite chemical potential. These kinds of examples have been proposed, and you know, as far as I know, they're not they're consistent with the no-go theorem. They've also been proposed in the context of pre-thermal systems exhibiting pre-thermalization, but interestingly, they've been argued to be impossible in non-Floquet MBL systems. So there's this paper which provides an alternative definition of a time crystal, and they kind of make an offhand remark in that paper that it appears that in non-Floquet MBL systems, this is impossible. However, they don't prove that it's possible there. They just say that it looks unlikely. So yeah. And also, there's no experiments so far. So that's another sort of reason that this subject is a little bit at a disadvantage relative to the Floquet case.
Sorry, just a matter of definition. So sure. When you say non-Floquet MBL, you mean MBL that's not Floquet? Or?
Yes, an MBL system that's not Floquet.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. So because the first sort of examples, like this Elsbauer, Nyack paper, MBL is actually, MBL plus Floquet is important. It's important to have both of those. Pre-thermalization kind of acts as a stand-in for MBL. So you need MBL or you need some pre-thermalization or something like this. But this, you know, these scar states, it's not really clear, like, they don't really fall into either of those categories. Although I guess if you kind of, if you want to think of PXP as some deformation, some weakly perturbed perfect model, then maybe these would be an example of a pre-thermal effect. Okay, so I want to show that there is this kind of time crystalline order in this PXP model. So to have a space-time crystal, basically we need this equation to be true. So I had the scaling of z pi at equal times before. Now I want to look at unequal times and see that this approaches a periodic function as L goes to infinity. And actually, if you take this quantity and compute the expectation value in a scar state, you can sort of convince yourself that it's plausible that this would happen. I'll show numerics later. But you know, to see that it's plausible, basically, you know, if you expand this thing, you see that you kind of end up with these matrix elements here of z pi between consecutive scar states. And those components oscillate with a frequency omega that's just set by the spacing between consecutive scar states. So basically, if the matrix elements between consecutive scar states of this operator z pi are, you know, exponentially larger than other matrix elements in your system, then, you know, it's you could imagine that this is happening. And this is plausible, actually, within this Magnon picture, because the operator z pi is nothing but the sum of s plus pi and s minus pi. So if you want to think of this s plus pi as approximately mapping you from one scar state to the next, or from one scar state to some superposition of scar states, which is closer to the, to what's actually happening, you can confirm that numerically. Then actually, that kind of immediately tells you that these are the objects that are important. So this is really a consequence of the Magnon picture. And that's what's being shown here. So what we're computing here is basically the average of this expectation value of z pi between scar states m minus 1 and m, and m and m plus 1. So we're looking at that average. And actually, you can check that matrix elements of z pi between other scar states, like between m and m plus 2, or m minus 2, and further neighbors, those are actually almost zero. And also, you know, typical matrix elements of this operator are zero basically by ETH reasons. Even if one of the states here, say you have M and then some other typical state, you can actually convince yourself that those matrix elements have to be small if the other state is ETH. So then you can look at scaling and see that it looks pretty good. So if you're looking at scar states that are low in the energy spectrum, these matrix elements are scaling to zero, indicating that you know there's no long-range order in those states, and also these matrix elements are small. And then if you look at the scar states in the middle of the spectrum, you see that this thing is scaling to something finite. And then if you look at something in between, it looks like that's also scaling to something finite. I'm going to talk about these points later, if you're suspicious of them. Oh, I'm going to wrap up. The point is that you know there are these things, and if you deform, again, everything looks better. And then also you can look at this in real time. And if you look at it in real time, you see these very nice oscillations of this unequal time correlation function when you start in one of the scar states. But then if you start in a ground state or a typical highly excited state, these things are small. So this is kind of suggesting that what the experiment is actually seeing, this is kind of, there's a hypothesis that you can draw based on this, that what the experiment was actually seeing is kind of a signature of this. And that's related to Andreas's question earlier. And you can test this hypothesis in more detail by looking at unequal time correlators of y's, which should also show similar behavior. That's basically the summary. So it looks like there is some Magnon description of these scar states that you can formulate. And this Magnon description has some interesting consequences, including the existence of a long-range order in both space and time in these scar states. And every result that I showed for the PXP model seems to get enhanced when the model is deformed to this perfect point. These are some interesting open questions. There's still a lot left to do on this subject. We need to develop a better understanding of what these states are in the PXP model. So can we think about Magnon interactions in this model? To what extent are constraints really necessary? I think those are interesting questions. You could also ask, you know, is there really a perfect point somewhere in parameter space? And if so, how do you find it? There's a question of, you know, we have these other examples like the AKLT tower of states where there are really perfect scar states. And we also have other examples of systems with invariant subspaces in Hilbert space or this embedded Hamiltonian picture where there are strong ETH violating states in the spectrum. And it would be interesting to try to see if the PXP model really falls into one of these categories or if the PXP model with its deformation to the perfect point really falls into one of these categories or if it's something totally new that we don't understand yet. And you know, to do that, we're going to need that perfect point Hamiltonian. So that's it. Thanks.
Any quick questions?
Yeah.
I saw that Lessig Modrulic had a paper on some exact scars. So is that already like this perfect Hamiltonian you're looking for, are these states without the Hamiltonian?
No. So there the states are. So the Hamiltonian is the PXP model, per se. It is the exact PXP model. The scar state there, basically they found essentially one scar state. And it's not one of these state, it's an ETH violating state, but it's not one of the states that contributes to the dynamics. So basically this model, this PXP model, because of the energy reflection symmetry and spatial inversion symmetry, has a huge degeneracy at zero energy. And basically what they found is that, you know, living in that degenerate manifold where you're free to take superpositions of many, many states, you can actually find an exact matrix product state that's living there.
It's one state.
Yeah, and it happens to be the AKLT state, which is kind of interesting. And there's a paper that came out like a couple weeks ago by Naoto Shiraishi, who showed actually why that state is there. Like, why is it the AKLT state? So that's actually a really interesting paper. I don't think it sheds much light on these log entangled states, unfortunately. But it does show you that Hamiltonian, you know, the PXP model can have some surprising, you know, you can make surprising exact statements about models that, you know, nominally don't appear to have any such statements, intrinsic within them. Yeah.
So does this Magnon approximation suggest some like semi-classical interpretation?
Yeah, that would be, it would be really interesting. Yeah, like, you know, it'd be interesting to see whether, you know, maybe there's some like large S description or something where you have like large spin Magnons. I'm not really sure, actually. It's not, there isn't like an obvious, you know, semi-classical picture that's implied by the picture, Magnon picture that comes to mind, but there may very well be such a picture.
So what does the entanglement entropy of scalar state look like in real space?
In real space?
Yeah.
So you mean as a function of the cut? Or?
Yeah, exactly.
So you would, it would grow logarithmically, right?
Yeah, that's what system size.
Well, sort of making
some kind of should have like at least something like a safety type of thing, right?
Oh, I see. So you're saying, I see what you mean. I haven't seen actually any fits to CFT, but it would be interesting. I don't know if the CFT is necessarily relevant here because these are very highly excited states, but at the same time, CFTs can have very highly excited states that exhibit oscillations. There's this paper by John McGreevy from a few years ago where actually they show that any CFT on a sphere has states that oscillate forever, and they're highly excited. So it's actually quite interesting. I wonder if there is a connection to that, but I'm not sure.
Okay, let's thank Tom again.
All right. Thanks.